listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It's really sad. It's almost heartbreaking to acknowledge the deep damage that the president has caused to our democracy and to all Western democracies under the threat from Putin.
That was the House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on Tuesday as she led a group of Democratic members of Congress criticizing the president's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin early this week.
In 1975, America and the Western world united to counter the Soviet threat by forming the Helsinki Commission. And well, that was really the work of President Ford, who was part of the negotiation and also signing the accord.
Then President Ford and the then Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev were among the 35 heads of state who signed the Helsinki Accords on August 1st, 1975. President Ford spoke at the signing.
Military competition must be controlled. Political competition must be restrained. Crises must not be manipulated or exploited for unilateral advantages that could lead us again to the brink of war. The process of negotiation must be sustained, not at a snail's pace, but with demonstrated enthusiasm and visible progress.
At the time that President Ford spoke those words, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had achieved détente. 43 years later, the situation between Washington and Moscow has become much more tense. That didn't appear to be of any concern to Representative Pelosi on Tuesday, who was more focused on the 2018 elections.
Instead of standing up for our democracy and democratic principles, President Trump cowered in the presence of Putin, and the entire world watched and saw that. Trump's eagerness to sell out America proves the Russians must have something personally, politically, or financially on President Trump. As DNI Dan Coats has said, the intelligence community has stated the Russians are once again waging a campaign to interfere in our elections. But President Trump continues to take the word of Russians, enthusiastically embracing their excuses, and the president gave a green light to continue to attack our democracy to the Russians. Yesterday, the president sided with the enemy who made an assault on our democracy.
Also on Tuesday, Trump held a meeting with some lawmakers at the White House. That meeting began like this.
My meeting with President Putin was really interesting in so many different ways, because we haven't had relationships with Russia for a long time. And we started. Let me begin by saying that, once again, full faith and support for America's intelligence agencies. I have a full faith in our intelligence agencies. Whoops, they just turned off the light. That must be the intelligence agencies. There it goes. Okay.
The lights in the room had gone out for a moment.
You guys okay? It was strange, but that's okay. So I'll begin by stating that I have full faith and support for America's great intelligence agencies, always had. And I have felt very strongly that while Russia's actions had no impact at all on the outcome of the election, let me be totally clear in saying that, and I've said this many times, I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also. There's a lot of people out there. There was no collusion at all. And people have seen that, and they've seen that strongly. The House has already come out very strongly on that. A lot of people have come out strongly on that. I thought that I made myself very clear by having just reviewed the transcript. Now, I have to say, I came back and I said, what is going on? What's the big deal? So I got a transcript. I reviewed it. I actually went out and reviewed a clip of an answer that I gave. And I realized that there is a need for some clarification. It should have been obvious. I thought it would be obvious, but I would like to clarify just in case it wasn't. In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't, or why it wouldn't be Russia. So, just to repeat it, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. And the sentence should have been, and I thought it would be maybe a little bit unclear on the transcript or unclear on the actual video. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative. So you can put that in, and I think that probably clarifies things pretty good by itself. I have on numerous occasions noted our intelligence findings that Russians attempted to interfere in our elections. Unlike previous administrations, my administration has and will continue to move aggressively to repeal any efforts and repel. We will stop it. We will repel it. Any efforts to interfere in our elections. We're doing everything in our power to prevent Russian interference in 2018. And we have a lot of power. As you know, President Obama was given information just prior to the election, last election, 2016, and they decided not to do anything about it. The reason they decided that was pretty obvious to all. They thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. And they didn't think it was a big deal. When I won the election, they thought it was a very big deal. And all of a sudden, they went into action, but it was a little bit late. So he was given that in sharp contrast to the way it should be. And President Obama, along with Brennan and Clapper and the whole group that you see on television now, probably getting paid a lot of money by your networks, they knew about Russia's attempt to interfere in the election in September. And they totally buried it. And as I said, they buried it because they thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win. turned out didn't happen that way. By contrast, my administration has taken a very firm stance. It's a very firm stance on a strong action. We're going to take strong action to secure our election systems and the process. Furthermore, as has been stated, and we've stated it previously and on many occasions, no collusion. Yesterday, we made significant progress toward addressing some of the worst conflicts on Earth. So when I met with President Putin for about 2.5 hours, we talked about numerous things. And among those things are the problems that you see in the Middle East, where they're very much involved, we're very much involved. I entered the negotiations with President Putin from a position of tremendous strength. Our economy is booming, and our military is being funded $700 billion this year, $716 billion next year. It will be more powerful as a military than we've ever had before. President Putin and I addressed the range of issues, starting with the civil war in Syria and need for humanitarian aid and help for people in Syria. We also spoke of Iran and the need to halt the nuclear ambitions and the destabilizing activities taking place in Iran. As most of you know, we ended the Iran deal, which was one of the worst deals anyone could imagine. And that's had a major impact on Iran, and it's substantially weakened Iran. And we hope that at some point Iran will call us and we'll maybe make a new deal, or we maybe won't. But Iran is not the same country that it was 5 months ago, that I can tell you. They're no longer looking so much to the Mediterranean and the entire Middle East. They've got some big problems that they can solve probably much easier if they deal with us. So we'll see what happens. But we did discuss Iran. We discussed Israel and the security of Israel. And President Putin is very much involved now with us in a discussion with Bibi Netanyahu on working something out with surrounding Syria and Syria, and specifically with regards to the security and long-term security of Israel. A major topic of discussion was North Korea and the need for it to remove its nuclear weapons. Russia has assured us of its support. President Putin said he agrees with me 100%, and they'll do whatever they have to do to try and make it happen. Discussions are ongoing, and they're going very, very well. We have no rush for speed. The sanctions are remaining. The hostages are back. There have been no tests. There have been no rockets going up for a period of 9 months. And I think the relationships are very good. So we'll see how that goes. We have no time limit. We have no speed limit. We have we're just going through the process. But the relationships are very good. President Putin is going to be involved in the sense that he is with us. He would like to see that happen. Perhaps the most important issue we discussed at our meeting prior to the press conference was the reduction of nuclear weapons throughout the world. The United States and Russia have 90%, as I said, and we can have a big impact. But nuclear weapons is, I think, the greatest threat of our world today. And they're a great nuclear power. We're a great nuclear power. We have to do something about nuclear. And so that was a matter that we discussed actually in great detail, and President Putin agrees with me. The matters we discussed are profound in their importance and have the potential to save millions of lives. I understand the many disagreements between our countries, but I also understand that dialogue and the when you think about a dialogue with Russia or dialogue with other countries, but dialogue with Russia in this case, where we've had such poor relationships for so many years, dialogue is a very important thing and it's a very good thing. So if we get along with them, great. If we don't get along with them, then we won't get along with them. But I think we have a very good chance of having some very positive things. I thought that the meeting that I had with President Putin was really strong. I think that they were willing to do things that, frankly, I wasn't sure whether or not they would be willing to do. And we'll be having future meetings, and we'll see whether or not that comes to fruition. But we had a very, very good meeting. So I just wanted to clear up. I have the strongest respect for our intelligence agencies headed by my people. We have great people, whether it's Gina or Dan Coats or any of them. I mean, we have tremendous people, tremendous talent within the agencies. I think they're being guided properly. And we all want the same thing. We want success for our country.
Meanwhile, on Thursday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin spoke before the assembled staff of Russia's foreign ministry and laid out the tasks that he saw for the ministry shaping up on the international scene.
Thank you.
Colleagues,
I'm happy to see you at our traditional meeting. First of all, I would like to thank the leadership of the foreign ministry, all the diplomats, all the veterans of the diplomatic service for your contribution in developing international cooperation of our country. All of our diplomatic mission work together in a well-coordinated way, given the current situation in the world. Russia has been consistently pursuing an independent and well-balanced foreign policy. Russia's involvement in international affairs is based on our key national interest to create favorable and safe conditions for our country's breakthrough development to address immense social and economic tasks at hand, improve the quality of life for our people. Our people want Russia to be a strong, independent country. We are open to have equal partnership with all countries and regional alliances. Being a permanent member of the UN Security Council, Russia will always remain committed to the basic principles of this organization's sovereignty, equality, non-interference in the internal affairs of other states, and fair resolution of all conflicts. Working collectively based on international law, we can address the most complex international issues. Our pursuit of global security and stability, countering new threats and challenges, is in much demand worldwide. Our allies share our allies in the CSTO, BRICS, SCO share our views on the basic principles of the new world order. These countries constitute a majority of the planet's population. This is the approach that we will use in resolving acute international crisis. In Syria, we were able to defeat international terrorism, ISIS, and other terrorist groups. Thus, we were able to preserve the statehood of Syria and create conditions for the restoration of the Syrian economy and bringing back refugees. Once again, I would like to thank our military for their professionalism. And of course, diplomats too. They were also very much involved in what we're doing in Syria. Russia is doing good work in the Astana process. Earlier this year, we held Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Sochi, which was hugely successful, creating preconditions for legitimate restoration of the Syrian city. The next step would be convention of a constitutional commission and adoption of a new constitution under the aegis of the United Nations. Of course, humanitarian efforts to support Syria are also important, and we are very much involved in that. This would be important for Syria, for this region as a whole, and for many other countries around the world, because this would decrease the immigration burden on European countries. Collective efforts and dialogue is what Russia has always proposed for the Korean Peninsula as well. We work together in China to prepare a plan to normalize the situation there. We are happy that the principles proposed by us proved useful. The parties came to the negotiation table and abandoned actions which could have caused dramatic consequences. Recent positive trends, which were partly due to the efforts taken by President Trump, will continue further. But we also have negative examples where agreements we have reached together are abandoned. For example, I'm referring to the step taken by the United States in withdrawing from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Currently, it is extremely important to preserve this deal and prevent uncontrolled growth of tensions in the Middle East. The situation in southeastern Ukraine remains complex. The reasons are the same. The current Ukrainian authorities refuse to honor the commitments they have made in resolving this conflict. They are unwilling to engage in a dialogue with their own citizens, instead relying on brute force. We still believe that the Minsk agreements remain the only foundation for a peaceful resolution of the situation. Colleagues, what we are doing in the international arena, we don't do this just for the sake of some abstract greatness or to create problems for others. Our key goal, once again, I repeat, is to create conditions for our country's economic development. Within the next few years, Russia should firmly secure a place among top five economic superpowers in the world and improve the living standards of our people. To achieve these strategic goals, we have to take advantage of all the opportunities that we have in the international arena. We should be practical, securing new markets, expanding our exports, bringing in new technology, overcome existing barriers that stand in the way of Russian companies working abroad. The principle of competition and openness is often replaced with protectionism in international trade today. Market values are replaced with political expediency. Trade is being politicized. Russia's foreign policy, on the contrary, should be more economically oriented and more rational. It is particularly important to create space of good neighborly relations, security and stability around our country. The Eurasian Economic Union is, of course, a key integration project for Russia. We are happy that our partners are working together with us in Eurasec, and this work is quite effective. We're using integration opportunities to stimulate the growth of the economies of all member states. And we want people and companies to feel the practical result of this work. We have a free trade zone with Vietnam. We are engaged in talks with Israel. Serbia, Singapore soon will start talks with India. We've prepared a free trade agreement with Iran. On the whole, we have about 50 treaties being prepared with the Eurasec. We have good prospects in working together with China. In March, Eurasec signed an agreement with China on trade cooperation. Eurasec and China's initiative of One Belt, One Road complement each other. Harmonizing these projects will provide a strong foundation for a greater Eurasian partnership, space for economic cooperation free from all sorts of barriers. This is the logic that we should also use in developing our relations with the European Union. Despite current difficulties, the EU remains one of our key trade partners. We have a lot of economic interests in common with the EU. For decades, we've been developing together our transport and infrastructure. All the business projects that we have with Europe, including, for example, Nord Stream 2, are purely commercial, economically feasible. There is no political subtext to it. The key to ensuring security and stability in Europe is in expanding cooperation and rebuilding trust, not in deploying new military bases and military infrastructure close to Russian borders, which is what is happening right now. Such aggressive actions posing direct threat to Russia, we will respond to them appropriately. To our colleagues who seek escalation, trying to draw Ukraine or Georgia into NATO should consider the consequences of their irresponsible policies. What we need today is constructive, positive agenda, bringing our positions closer. This is what we discussed in my meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump. Even though our views are vastly different, we both agreed that relations between Russia and the U.S. are unsatisfactory. In many ways, they are even worse than during the Cold War. It would be naive to think that problems that have been accumulated over the years can be resolved within just a few hours. Nobody expected that, of course. Still, I believe that we've started on our way towards this goal. It is good that we finally had an opportunity to have a proper meeting. We'll have to wait and see how events will unfold, especially considering that certain forces in the U.S. can want to play down the results of the Helsinki summit. Well, I would like to say now a few words ad lib, in a way. We know that there are certain forces in the United States which can sacrifice, which would be happy to sacrifice U.S.-Russia relations for the sake of their domestic political goals. They are ready to sacrifice the interests of their businesses. U.S. companies are losing millions in contracts, losing jobs, their cooperation with Russian partners. These are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of jobs. They are willing to sacrifice the interests of their allies in Europe and in the Middle East. For example, I'm referring to Israel. We also talked about the Golan Heights when we talked about Syria. And it seems like they're not interested in that. They're also willing to sacrifice the issues of their own security. I'd like to point out to you that in 2021, the New START treaty will expire. We can live without this treaty. Just a few years ago, we could have lived without this treaty, but we did the right thing and signed this treaty. And we need to start working today to prolong, to extend this treaty. Otherwise, in a year and a half, it will just run out its course, and there will be no more treaty any longer. When I talk about these forces in the United States, you know, this is not in line with our political philosophy, because we've always been taught that people who work for the state in the interest of their nation should first and foremost think about the fundamental principles, fundamental values of their country. But no, there are forces in the United States that only care about their own private interests. These are the kind of people who are pitiful, petty, despicable people, as they were described in Soviet books. But on the contrary, I think these people are quite smart sometimes. For example, when they want to feed their stories to people, they use this as a pretext. They do this not to praise someone or to criticize someone. The reason I mention this is because I want us to take this into account in our practical work when we deal with Americans. These are just facts that we face today. Still, Russia is open to develop contacts with the United States as long as they're based on equality. This is not something that just our two countries need. The whole world needs this. Being two nuclear superpowers, we have special responsibility for global security and stability. Now I'd like to say a few words on a totally different subject. The FIFA World Cup has just completed. We had many world leaders visiting our country, and also hundreds of thousands of football fans from all over the world. They saw a different kind of Russia, Russia that is open to the world, Russia that is friendly. This is an obviously a breakthrough. This is what we can call popular democracy, and you made an important contribution to that as well. Congratulations. And thank you. Colleagues, of course, the burden on the foreign ministry, on our diplomatic mission, will only keep increasing more and more. But I would like to assure you that Russia's leadership will always do everything necessary to support you, take care of your material situation, protect people who work in the foreign ministry. We have made a number of important decisions to this effect. At the same time, on some of the sensitive issues, salaries, social guarantees for your family members, housing conditions, we haven't been able to fully resolve those issues yet, and I would like the cabinet, the government, to pay special attention to these matters and not deal with them in a bureaucratic manner. We need to provide proper conditions for our diplomats to perform their professional functions. This is extremely important. This concludes the first part of my speech, and the next part will take place behind closed doors without the media.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly said he wants better relations with Russia. He did finally have his long-sought summit with Vladimir Putin. Both presidents called it a success. The American political class and corporate media described the Helsinki summit as a failure, and Trump even worse. Are the United States and Russia destined to be enemies forever? Crosstalking Russophobia, I'm joined by my guest Brian Becker in Washington. He's the director of the Answer Coalition, as well as host of Loud and Clear, a daily news show on Radio Sputnik. Also in Washington, we have Earl Rasmussen. He is the executive vice president of the Eurasia Center. And in Managua, we cross to Dan Kovalik. He is an adjunct professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, as well as author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Dan, when did you finish writing your book? The date?
Yes, last year, like last spring, May.
What did you know that we didn't know then? Because it sounds like an absolutely perfect title for the moment in the current news cycle. Go ahead.
Well, Russia's been a scapegoat of the United States for a long, long time. You know, we could go as far back, certainly as 1917, but certainly after World War II. We had what was known as the Cold War, which centered upon the vilification of Russia to justify the U.S.'s adventures abroad. And we are in a new Cold War now, and we were in one at the time I wrote the book, and it seems to be only intensifying. Even though the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the U.S. continues to vilify Russia and paint it as some enemy that it's not.
Okay, Brian, what I find really interesting, and it's a saga that's been going on here, is that it seems to me that very, very often the United States and its Western allies, particularly NATO, they project all of their own sins upon Russia, okay, meddling in other people's election. Well, we could spend an entire month on a daily basis going through all of the meddling that the United States and its allies have been involved in for the last few decades, and it would still be a cursory review. I mean, it seems to me that Russia plays this other, the opposite, the negative of what we want to see in ourselves. Go ahead, Brian.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go through, and people have gone through, the record of the United States not just interfering in other elections, including Russia's in 1996, there's that famous Time magazine, right, of Boris Yeltsin with the American flag, and it says Yanks to the rescue, because America flooded Moscow with American advisors and millions of dollars to make sure their candidate, Boris Yeltsin, won. Otherwise, the Communist Party in Russia would have actually been the winner. But it's not just interference. If the U.S. doesn't like the results of elections after they've tried to influence them, then they overthrow the government. This is what happened with the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. It dared to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. So, of course, the U.S. overthrew it and imposed on Iran the Shah, a monarch. You can't get a more or less democratic government. There's a long history of this. The United States, the media presentation here is so incredible. You had Donald Trump going to Europe, meeting with the NATO countries, demanding that they spend $132 billion more aggregate for really a confrontational position against Russia. And then he gets to Russia, I mean to Helsinki, and meets with Putin. And the American media says this is the surrender summit.
The surrender summit.
And acting as if... You know, here's the United States spends $780 billion on war every year. Russia spends $60 billion, and yet Russia's on the march.
You know, Earl, and
incredible.
And Russia's defense spending is on decline right now. OK, it's not being increased here. Earl, does the United States need Russia as an enemy? Is this because to justify all of these expenditures? OK, I mean, Brian is logically looking at it, but logic and politics don't always parlay. OK, I mean, essentially, we need an enemy. It justifies this here. Montenegro is adding a value added to NATO's defense, okay? Montenegro's army is smaller than the New York police force, okay? But we need an enemy here. Is that what Russia's purpose is? Because it's really easy to paint Russia as an enemy is because it really demands stubbornly its sovereignty. Go ahead, Earl.
No, I agree, Peter. I mean, we need, let's face it, it's the defense industry. We need an enemy. NATO is searching for a new mission. I mean, really, it's a good defense grouping, but, you know, should Russia be included in that as well? And what's the real mission? The mission is not there. I don't think there's any fear for Russia invading into any part of Europe. But you need a boogeyman. You need a threat to justify defense expenditures. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower... cited be aware of the defense industry. And they all do great things. They do some, you know, positive research. There's a lot of people employed. But, you know, to grow business, you need more threats. And so I think it is, in some ways, it's a business. It's a racket, you know. And essentially, that's what it is. War is a racket, and conflict is a racket. And a lot of people make money from it.
You know, Dan, the World Cup just ended here in Russia, and Moscow was one of the major centers for the matches. And I purposely went into the center of town almost every single day and ran into people. Some people recognized me or in a cafe. People would ask me questions or direction or something. We'd get into a conversation, and I purposely said, "What are you most surprised about?" And the reaction was almost universal. People were exasperated. I had no idea this place was like this, because in the UK, they tell us a completely different story. They even told us it could be dangerous to come here. And the reaction was anger. Anger that, you know, what the hell were they telling us? Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, no, I mean, the vilification of Russia is, frankly, mind-boggling. Here's a country that right after 9/11, Vladimir Putin was the first world leader to call President Bush and send his condolences. He offered help in the war on terror and gave help in the war on terror. Russia is actually playing a very constructive role in the Middle East. Even Israel is finding Russia to be a reliable partner in the Middle East. This vilification has no grounding in facts. And as you pointed out, what appears to be greatly resented in the political halls of the United States is that Russia's gotten back on its feet.
Yeah.
And it is a country that is livable. And it is a country that people are happy in. And that's why they have a very high approval rating for their president. And I think that is why people are surprised when they go there. And it's not some kind of a hellhole, because that's what we're led to believe.
And I should point out to our viewers that Russia is the second country after the United States destination for immigrants. Russia is number two in the world. People do want to come here, though I suppose you would never hear that on CNN. Brian, another thing is here, Russia is a reliable enemy, but it's also the only bipartisan issue that you get America's divided political class. It really works, okay? It brings people together, all right? And I think that's also its purpose, okay, is that, and it's also a justification for the Democrats why they lost the election, because they still can't come to terms with it. They remain in denial. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, there's another issue that there's a bipartisan support, and the two are closely linked, which is the absolute support for the military-industrial complex and the intelligence agencies. So both the Democrats and the Republicans routinely and almost unanimously support these gargantuan increases in the U.S. military budget. Again, it was an $82 billion increase this year. That's more than Russia's entire military budget. That was supported by the Democrats and the Republicans. So they come together on this issue, and Russia, as our other guests have said, is an essential part of the expansion of the U.S. military machine, because why are we going to spend $1 trillion a year on war? Is it going to be against Grenada? Is it going to be against little tiny countries? You need a major power sort of enemy. And then the national security strategy that was unveiled in January, and Trump himself came out to do it, maybe because of his narcissism, he came out to announce it, unlike previous presidents. It says that the main priority for the U.S. military in the coming decade and decades is not Islamic terrorism, it's not terrorism at all. It's for major power confrontation with Russia and China. That's budgeting and military contingency planning. Now, to do that, you have to really paint the adversary as an adversary. So it's an article of faith. There's a new religion in Washington, D.C., which is called I Hate Religion, I Hate Russia, Russia is the Enemy. And we all must bow and genuflect at the altar of this new religious icon. And that's the way you can take the American people's money, hard-earned tax dollars, which could be used for housing and health care and education, the things human beings need, and shovel it over to the defense contractors. You have to explain to them that it's an absolute national imperative to do that in order to carry out this looting of the national budget. And that's what we're witnessing right now.
Let me go to Earl before we go to the break here. Manufactured consent. This is what Russophobia in its most recent incarnation. It's manufactured consent. And I want to talk about the intelligence community in the second half of the program. But the liberal media loves it, and they perpetrate it. Go ahead, Earl. 30 seconds.
It is manufactured consent, and it's and I believe it's probably orchestrated somewhere in the dark corners as well. I mean, what do we have here? We have McCarthyism 2.0. Even if you shake an ambassador's hand at a reception, you're Putin's.
Or that young lady that was just arrested because she was, you know. She had some kind of agenda here. I mean, because she's not a foreign agent. Well, hell, half of Washington should be a foreign agent under those strictures here. Okay, I'm sorry, Earl. Let me jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Russophobia. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Dan in Managua. I think also part of what Brian was saying, this new religion, as it were, that's so bipartisan and the liberal media loves to propagate, is that I think we should question the intelligence community. I think that's a really important thing to do. I mean, again, if you can go back and look at the history of their behavior, Bay of Pigs, I mean, their involvement in Vietnam, all the issues surrounding 9/11. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, and then you listen to Peter Strzok, okay? I mean, all the more reason to be very skeptical of what's going on behind, you know, closed doors in the deep state here. I mean, I don't understand. It's gotten to the point where questioning anything now, you end up being ostracized and demonized. Like, you know, the left wasn't always that way. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, no, I mean, for many years, the left understood that the CIA was this pretty diabolical institution that was engaged in regime change abroad and murdering world leaders. The CIA lied us into the war with Iraq in 2003 with the lie about weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, you know, led to over 1 million Iraqis dead, 5,000 Americans dead, and trillions of dollars wasted. And yet those lies are forgotten. And the irony, of course, is that it tends to be the liberals now that are rallying around the CIA and the FBI. The FBI, which is for years engaged in infiltrating progressive organizations and peace organizations to disrupt them, who killed Fred Hampton, a leader of the Black Panthers, in cold blood. And now somehow the FBI is supposed to be our hero. I mean, yeah. It's really incredible.
You know, Brian, one of the things I think it's very interesting and very tragic here is that somehow Russia meddled in America's democracy. I don't even really know what that means, but you hear it all of the time. But what really is happening, I think, my personal opinion, is that because there isn't any questioning of the intelligence community in their behavior, and I'm thinking of the FBI during the 2016 election, they are damaging America's democracy because you cannot ask these questions about what they did. I mean, the FBI, the DOJ, was created by Congress, right? They fund these agencies. And what we see is obstruction. So I can't, you know, meddling, okay, I have no idea what that really means. But we're getting more and more information that the kind of regime change scenario the U.S. has used around the world for decades has actually come home, and they're practicing the same playbook. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, and in fact, that's gone on for decades. I agree with Dan Kovalik. Why would anyone trust the FBI or the CIA? And certainly progressive people or people who used to consider themselves liberal. I don't even know what the word liberal means anymore. Yeah. It doesn't mean anything. Here's the situation is this. The U.S. government says that Russia meddled by hacking into the Democratic National Committee email server and revealing emails that showed that the Democratic Party leadership violated its own rules and regulations to make sure that Hillary Clinton would win the nomination. Now, if that's true and it's being described as a parallel or synonymous with what happened on 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, why did the FBI not subpoena and take control of that server to carry out a forensic investigation? Why did it allow CrowdStrike, a third party that had its own self-interest and its own political bias against Russia, why did they take their word that, in fact, the Democratic Party server was hacked by the Russians? That on its face would make anyone skeptical. But again, if you're in a religious situation, you don't need proof. You only take things as an article of faith. And so if the FBI says we have a high degree of confidence without giving any evidence that Russia did this, without any evidence, if you're in a religious mode, you say, I believe. Yeah. I believe because I believe, because I'm part of the religion. And that's the situation right now. If those of us who question this narrative continue to question, we're considered to be non-believers. And like a witch hunt, if you're not part of the witch hunt, you perhaps become a witch yourself. Yep. And it creates an atmosphere of political intimidation. That's what we're experiencing right here in Washington, D.C.
You know, and Earl, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the number on the top of my head, but the NSA, isn't it their kind of job to be seeing what's moving around on the internet, you know, from sensitive places and all that? You know, I mean, again, there are very intelligent people that are former members of the intelligence community that can make a very strong case that this is like a leak, not a hack. And these people have done it using their, you know, what's in between their ears, their brain, okay? They're not the NSA here. I'm thinking of William Beeney and people like that, Ray McGovern. I don't think they're traitors to their country, though they are very, very critical of the places they used to work for. Go ahead, Earl.
Absolutely. NSA should be able to isolate down to the building, you know, where the path of traffic was. They're definitely monitoring almost everything, not just foreign traffic, but internal as well. But you're absolutely correct on the forensic analysis. So, I mean, where's the real forensic analysis? Where's the independent forensic analysis? The closest thing that's happened is come out of the veteran intelligence organization Vinny's part of.
Hey, right.
Veeps, absolutely. That's the only thing that's even been close, and that verifies that it had to be an internal leak. So I'm very, very skeptical on any of this.
You know, Earl,
dialogue
let me just jump in here real quickly. I remember, I think I'm going to remember this correctly. I think it was in January or February of this year that Veeps was actually talking about it. And then months later, Hannity on Fox started talking about it. Consider what the kind of news environment we have. So, some really smart people that know what they're talking about write about this, put it out in public. I think it was consortiumnews.com. And it didn't even make an impression on the mainstream. And then maybe somebody said, hey, have you read this? Because this is exactly what Hannity would like. But for me, it was astounding. So this information was around for months. And it didn't even penetrate. It was amazing. It's a small circle of us. Dan, I want to change gears. Are Russia and the United States destined to be enemies for good? Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I certainly don't believe, you know, that they're destined to be so. I believe that there's a lot of common interest there. I think we should be friends and partners. However, I believe, you know, as Eric Hobsbawm, the historian, pointed out, you know, the hatred of Russia is in the DNA of the American people, and not by genetics, but because it was put there by people who found a reason to vilify Russia. But it does appear that, you know, the powers that be in this country will continue to stoke the flames of anti-Russia hatred in the interest of war, which will make it very difficult for us to be partners. And I think that's a tragic thing.
You know, Brian, I've heard repeatedly the Russian meddling, again, whatever that means, is akin to Pearl Harbor. Well, what did the United States do as a reaction to the attack on Pearl Harbor? It completely mobilized its economy and fought a very hard, very bloody war, and justified, in my opinion, okay? But what kind of rhetoric is this now? You know, then what should the U.S. do? And then all of us on this program know the very importance of arms control agreements. I know it's not really sexy for MSNBC and CNN. They just have low octane intelligence, okay? But this is important stuff here, and it has to be dealt with. I really wish that Donald Trump had a little bit more finesse. I know that's hard for him, really hard for him, but that's a really important issue, okay? And we need to move forward on that. But if we're going to be enemies, how can you go there? This is one of the great tragedies. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, after September 11th, which is this is being compared to, and Pearl Harbor, the U.S. went to war against Japan in World War II, of course, and then after September 11th, the war on terror. The U.S., I believe we're past the point of no return in terms of the animus and hostility towards Russia. I don't think we're coming back. Donald Trump, as you said, all of the media attention was on his very badly stated positions at the Helsinki. But actually what they talked about was Syria and deconfliction. They talked about the possibility of improving the START Treaty. The START Treaty was signed in 1991. It said the United States, which has 7,000 operational nuclear weapons, all of which, just a few of which could destroy the entire world, and Russia, which has a similar number, that they should be reduced down to 1,550 and then more. That's a requirement also, an affirmative obligation from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty on all nuclear powers. They talked about that. That was not covered, as you're saying, Peter. That's a big issue. The danger of nuclear war, even an accidental nuclear war, the catastrophic consequences are so profound. Why don't we talk about that? Talk about meddling in the future of the world. Nuclear weapons are meddling in our future. Having control over those nuclear weapons, getting rid of them, that's critically important. That seems to be off the agenda right now.
What's Earl, what I think is really, really tragic in this environment that we're right now is that, you know, negotiations are equated with appeasement. This is the tragedy of the conversation right now, okay? And arms control is so very important. But if you negotiate, it means surrender summit. Go ahead, Earl.
No, I think you're right. It's personally, this meeting is something that should have taken place a while ago, and I think a dialogue is absolutely necessary. Are we going to agree in things? Absolutely not. But it's definitely necessary for agreement. And for some reason, these major areas of collaboration and coordination are not. Are bypassed by the media, and it's very, very unfortunate.
Well, we'll see where it goes here, gentlemen, but considering the way things are going, it seems to me that the U.S.-Russia relationship has been spoiled, and it could last for generations. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and Managua, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.